So having wasted my breath reading about Trump's latest trumpetings, because it's quite clear that this guy is just a really master con artist who knows how to manipulate the media and also is aware that he has a corrupt Republican establishment who is running around screaming at the top of its lungs against him when he was running against them. But because he's successfully manipulated himself into a position of power through promising this to that person and that to this person, and, you know, essentially adopting a freewheeling style that sounds, and in a way, is more candid, except that it has no foundation in the sense of there's no principled behavior behind it. And the people he's got around him are these right-wing lunatics. And I say this, though, you know, with an understanding that you don't really have a left-wing opposition at all. You have a unified support of military imperial expansion and oppression abroad and all over, and locally at home as well, in terms of the inequitable distribution of resources, the kind of ongoing and increasing inequality, the militarization locally by police, and then, of course, abroad by the military, what's going on, that we are simply in the middle of, that is being supported by both parties who are simply sort of playing a game of really distraction. They'll distract you with issues like abortion. They'll distract you with additions like gun control, or we're going to take away your guns, you name it. Instead of looking at the real economic situation that people are suffering and the kind of conditions that are getting worse for average people. Anyway, I mean, the most recent thing out of The Independent in London is Trump delays plan for mass arrests and deportation of migrants. But who knows what he's doing? I mean, this is a guy who feels he no longer has to be responsible for what he said the day before. And therefore, you can't really take much of what he says seriously at all. It's hard to tell. It's just the only thing you can do is judge based upon the powers that he and those around him, or the Clintonites, if they were in power, would have. And therefore, that is really what you are confronting. You don't really have a rational basis for making any sound predictions about what these politicians are going to do. And to some extent, you see this locally. When you see the vacillations and peregrinations of Susie O'Hara and the former Tina Scholl. Well, she's still Tina Scholl, but she's now, I think, probably in a fancier position up in Scotts Valley. She's moved from city manager's office in Santa Cruz up there. But, you know, their endless comments about goals they never reached for creating homeless shelters in Santa Cruz, and the huge amounts of money being spent on the River Street campground, and the supposed additional shelter that would be available for people at the Ross camp so that they could follow the court's orders. They were either extremely optimistic predictions or simply lies. You can't really call it a lie if you say, we expect that this will be the situation. Because people can have very generous expectations and not be lying. They can be wrong. But there comes a point when you have to say there's something fundamentally dishonest and disingenuous about claiming you have shelter for people when you don't, particularly when it's impacting their lives so seriously and when it's being used quite cynically in order to pander to the baseless fears of people in neighborhoods who seem to feel that it's their privilege to exclude everyone who isn't wearing clean clothing and have a smile on their face from the neighborhood, or who doesn't have a piece of property that they can point to as something that is their little piece of the rock. I mean, it's, I guess the only hope that one would have is that this is not a majority of people. This is a minority who is very vocal and very well-heeled as well. Some of them aren't, because some people are scared. They see more and more homeless people. They see needles around. They see rude behavior from people who don't like being pushed around by the police. And it becomes tensions heighten. Let's get back into some more interviews. Enough of me and my alarmist tactics. It's about 2 o'clock on the 16th of June. I'm here at the, what do we call this complex?
This is King's Village.
King's Village in Scotts Valley. It's a shopping center. And we're talking to a nearby resident who occasionally uses the laundromat here, yeah? Or at least has noticed it.
Well, I notice. I come down along here. I'm a retired guy, so here I am on occasion. And this woman comes out and attacks people who are smoking, who obviously aren't employees of Nob Hill, and she, one of them the other day, she said that, called the police on him for smoking a cigarette. And when they got here, she accused him of exposing himself. And he had to go through a bunch of stuff.
And did you witness most of this interaction? Or?
No, it's all secondhand on my part, to be honest. I talked to several people who I talk to regularly who live here around town. They're not homeless, but they have very low incomes.
And, I imagine people using the laundromat probably aren't the richest in the world here. Have you heard that this woman, who I believe you initially called the smoke Nazi?
I told her that to her face when I saw her in action.
Does she go after customers as well as people who aren't customers?
No. She picks out the people who she deems are
non-contributing members of society.
Well, we're all members of society.
Well, there's some people we just really can't allow inside.
Well, you know, I don't know. No, we're all members. And she makes her
kind
choice.
Kind of liberal?
She makes her choice. You know, the guy she picks on comes down here and plays guitar, puts out his hat, and that offends her. If she smokes, or if they smoke, she's deeply offended by it. I asked her if she was an ex-smoker or maybe had been married to a smoker or was married to a smoker.
When did you talk to her?
This has been a month ago or so.
And does this fellow who does the guitar playing and the busking, I guess we'd call it,
he lives here. His father owns property on Scotts Valley Drive, actually quite wealthy, but he has problems, and he comes down here, and this is how he makes money.
Is he a person who lives outside?
Yeah, he lives outside his father's house, has a tent in a redwood grove over on Scotts Valley.
And is this behavior by she's a laundry worker here.
She's a customer.
She's a customer.
Yeah.
Has this deterred him from coming back, do you think?
No. She ran him off for a while because after she accused him, the police, who know him because of her complaints, have said they forced him to do some stuff, some kind of class. Or something.
Sex offender registration? Hopefully not.
No, he didn't have to register, but anytime a woman makes an accusation against a man, there's a knee-jerk reaction. And she accused him of exposing himself, so he had to go through an investigation. Mm-hmm. And wasn't good on his part. I've introduced him to people that I know, stand-up citizens. They'll like him. He comes over to our church. He is a good guy.
How frequently does he play here?
Many times late in the afternoon. He may be here this afternoon.
Does he also have CDs that he passes on, or is much just his direct music?
No, he comes down. It's a panhandle thing. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't get along with his father, who owns the property he lives on, but his father allows him to live in a tent outside. And I've never seen him misbehave, except he does get loose on occasion.
You guys know each other? And
I met him here. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, hey, this is something about this guy I like. Well, he's not a bad man. He's just a man who has.
How are Scotts Valley Police treating people who are panhandling up here? Have you noticed any general attitude one way or the other?
Unless someone like this woman makes a complaint, I don't see the Scotts Valley Police really harassing anybody, but I have seen them pick up people who are homeless and say, get in the car, I'm taking you to Santa Cruz. And they drop them off there.
Even if they don't want to go?
Even if they don't want to go. If they want to stay out of jail, they go to Santa Cruz. And they just get on the bus and come back. But
the police do this?
They don't do this to him. He lives here, and his dad has money.
How many times have you heard this happening to, you got direct accounts, or you observed this happening, this kind of get in the car, we're going to Santa Cruz stuff, or you just heard of it?
I've heard of it, and I've observed it myself half a dozen times over the last 2 years.
I don't think that police would do that.
Police do that. It's just, it's a question of if they can get away with it. And, I guess Weiss is retired. I don't know if he was any better or worse than the new police chief. I didn't know him personally very well, but we did speak once at Scotts Valley City Council trying to ask them to end the sleeping ban here, or actually opposing the law that they were considering, which would put into place a sleeping ban, which they did, unfortunately. That was 2007 or something like that. But I think you're right. I think it is. It's not only unprofessional and probably a violation of police procedures, but it's probably a violation of constitutional right to freedom of travel. You're not supposed to detain someone against their will unless you have probable suspicion of a crime. And I don't think... What crime do you think they were accusing these people of in Scotts Valley?
I really don't have a clue. To me, it's... They don't have the money, the income, or the living situation to be like everybody else in the parking lot. So since they can't do that, or somebody comes by and says they don't like them, they're panhandling, or they're stinky, or they look unkempt. They make a complaint, and the officer comes by, and if he interviews them and determines that they need to go, then they need to go.
Yeah, well, it's not up to him to make that decision, but he has the power to do it, or she does.
And I don't see where a lot of them really deserve that at all.
Next time that happens, I want a full report.
Okay. I have your card now.
You do, Jerry. Anything else you want to add before I roll? This will be probably, I'll put this out on the stream on Thursday evening, and it'll be on the card. You can check the times. Right. And if you don't catch it then, it'll be archived, so you can read it, you can hear it later.
I would encourage everyone to start paying attention. And It may just It may just be your perception. Your perception may not be right, but you need to talk about it. They say if you see something, report something. Well, you know, it's not just somebody waving a weapon around or something like that. It's the people who perceive themselves to be citizens. Just pay attention to what's going around. If you see something you don't think's right, talk about it.
Thank you. Anything you got you want to pass on from Reading?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
All right. Well, cool. Thank you. So not everybody is in the Take Back Santa Cruz crew, it sounds like. Thank you, Scotts Valley, for speaking up. I wouldn't have expected of you. I was prejudiced and sort of a stereotype about Scotts Valley, which it's interesting. I'm glad to have it contradicted. Well, recently Keith McHenry went to Washington, as did Alicia Kuhl and Wes White, two activists which regular listeners to this broadcast know all too well. And Keith also, of course, gives regular reports on what's going on in Santa Cruz and around Food Not Bombs chapters throughout the world, since he's deeply involved in that whole activity, writing a book about his, or another book, I should say, about his experiences here and there and there and here. Let's hear what he's got to say yesterday. So that laughter that you may or may not have heard in the background is Katzenjammer Keith McHenry, as only I call him. He's the local co-founder, well, he's the local activist and co-founder of Food Not Bombs, and he's also a man of many junkets. He was recently returned from Washington, D.C., where he has attended a conference of the Poor People's something, which also had a Union of the Homeless reconstitution get-together. Keith, what was that about?
The original people who had started the National Union of the Homeless had decided that they would propose a reestablishment of that. And so people, homeless and recently housed people, got together with a couple of activists like myself and the lawyer Anthony Prince, and we held a meeting, a couple of meetings, and the first one was we decided that we would create a committee to reestablish the National Union of the Homeless.
And this was some months ago, right?
No, this was, we've been talking about it for months, but we actually formally decided to start it. There was a vote of about 30 people from all across the United States that voted to agree to start this committee. And so now we're going to try to figure out, we're analyzing the mistakes of the original National Union of the Homeless and trying to figure out how to do it better and more effectively.
Can you tell me something about the history of the original National Union? I know a little bit because both you and I were around there, and of course I knew Terry Messman and Dorothy King in those days. They were involved with it, and particularly the Oakland chapter of the Union of the Homeless, which took over housing and... I was actually in, I don't know if you were involved in that, but I was, they arrested a couple of us on different occasions. We had them establish a multi-service center for all the good that did. I'm not sure whether it did good or not. Where did it come from? How long did it last? And why did it fail or end, I should say? It may have had a success, you know, even while it was there, and everything has its half-life, so, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. Well, it grew out of a number of different crises that were happening in after years of neoliberal structural adjustment by the Reagan administration, which saw like a huge increase in people living on the streets, and so the earliest people that helped form it were in Philadelphia, and at the time there was quite a campaign to demolish housing there because because there's a lot of abandoned housing, and then they would catch fire with people hanging out in them and stuff. And so the city started this massive campaign. And Kensington Welfare Rights was pushing back, Kensington being a part of the ghetto of West Philadelphia. And also at the same time, there was this, like we had a tent city protest in front of City Hall in San Francisco. There was a huge encampment that was filling Tompkins Square Park in Lower East Side of New York City. And really the combination of the people from Philadelphia and the people from the Tompkins Square Park initiated ultimately the National Union of the Homeless. And it ended up over time, it was about 20, 30 cities had locals, and it had about 15,000 to 20,000 members have added up roughly. And there are big things that happened where they organized, our Homes Not Jails kind of came out of that Housing Now actions that were going on, and that, as you recall, Terry and Dorothy were involved in that. Dorothy, I met in, and you may have first met, at the 1989 Tent City protest at City Hall. The examiner dubbed Camp Agnos in their effort to smear Agnos.
He was then mayor.
He was the mayor, liberal mayor at the time.
Mm-hmm. And not so liberal toward homeless people.
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. And not liberal. And, you know, he was like any pro-corporate liberal. He was pro-corporate stuff. Mm-hmm. And particularly vicious against homeless people. And so that inspired for us in part the Homes Not Jails actions that we started doing. So that was, while it wasn't officially a part of the National Union of the Homeless, it was part of a whole nationwide campaign of which a lot of housing takeovers were done by the National Union of the Homeless. And they pushed and were actually able to get HUD Secretary Jack Kemp to claim that he was going to do things for homeless people and provide 10% of HUD vacant buildings to house the homeless.
Which he never did, right?
Correct, yeah. So none of the stuff that happened during that really, you know, happened, unfortunately.
Well, what about the housing actually taken over? That, I don't give a shit about the politicians' promises, and I heard you had a big lineup of politicians chattering to the organizational meeting this last few days in Washington, D.C. I couldn't care less. In fact, I regard it as a supreme waste of time and a diversion, an illusion. But, you know, there were real things that the Union of the Homeless did on the ground, as I understand it, until there was a massive division, at least around in the Oakland Union of the Homeless. I know the Dorothy King and Terry Messman were at odds, and there was Terry never had a kind word to say about the Kensington Civil Homeless Organization out of which this came, and there was an issue about money. What do you think eventually, I know you haven't examined the issue recently closely, or maybe you have, but what do you think caused the downfall of this, or was it just something that, you know, happened?
Oh, I think there was a bunch of different problems, and one of them is that, like, you know, being, like, organized by people that were really marginalized and desperate, living on the streets, there were, you know, issues surrounding, power struggles and things like that. I don't know, I don't recall the Dorothy Terry split. Mm-hmm. Food Not Bombs did provide some food to what was going on there. I think Dorothy, my sense was that Dorothy was more about really actively working with the government and having this belief that actually they would succeed at getting the government to keep its promises. And Terry was, like, much more skeptical. But I don't know if that's really where the heart of the split was. You know, we'd have to talk to Terry and see what he has to say.
Has anyone done a study?
I'm not going to hold Dorothy anymore, but anyway,
has anyone done a study of the actual takeovers they did and how much of it, you know, retained its, you know, stayed in place. How many people actually got into housing because of these actual takeovers of abandoned buildings?
I don't really know if we made any particular headway in housing people as a result of that over the long term. I mean, people did get housed for, you know, short amounts of time. And we did make, you know, there was for a while like a sense of, you know, I think the main, most important single thing of the union of the homeless, probably even now, is and it's historically, is that it is homeless people themselves feeling like they are as the slogan was, homeless but not helpless, and trying to build like a, you know, less isolation amongst people living outside, and countering the narrative that the people that live outside are all like drug addicts and hopeless and out for their own selves, and they're homeless because of their personal failings. And so I think that the, you know, overcoming that, somewhat like the, you know, Black is Beautiful movement and Black Power, is kind of like a, least that. I think that could be the most powerful single thing, is people exerting their rights.
Black Lives Matter type stuff? Black Lives Matter type stuff.
Yeah, that kind of a thing where like now, you know, that homeless people, you know, are people and they're smart, and they're, you know, many of them are smart, intelligent. And so I said in my presentation at the workshop, which was at in D.C., you know, many of the homeless people are the people that built the houses, you know, wired the buildings, built the appliances, paved the roads of America. So homeless community already has built America. And so, you know, now we should, you know, the homeless community is capable of many, many things if we don't fight amongst each other. And I think that's where the issue is.
Was there any discussion at all, because this was a kind of day or two before our Fuhrer ordered the bombers over Iran and then decided to turn them back. Has there been any kind of intersection of the, you know, civil rights for the homeless movement, the National Union of the Homeless Formation, the Poor People's Campaign, with these, you know, issues that are seemingly really ignored at a national level by many organizations? I know today in Fresno, for instance, there's a meeting of the National Lawyers Guild nationally, as well as the an 50-year meeting of anti-war vets. I talked to Mike Rhodes, activist out there. You may remember Mike. Who has successfully survived cancer and is still kicking ass out there and writing and working and organizing events. But, in the course of that conversation with him, I had nothing to say, and it completely slipped my mind to say, well, by the way, we're about to embark into a war that's, or be dragged into a war or bumbled into a war. And nobody is really talking shit about it among the leftist groups. Did any of that come up at this meeting? And I guess if it didn't come up at this meeting, are you aware of anything happening nationally about that this weekend, now that the meeting's over, here in Santa Cruz and elsewhere?
Okay, well, now what the discussion was, which was huge and was probably, to me, one of the most astounding things about this Poor People's Congress, was that a main point was taking half of the military budget and diverting it to solutions for solving poverty in the United States. And so there was testimony before. So there was a moral budget that was presented to Congressional Budget, House Committee, which advocated a diversion of $300 billion a year from the military budget towards things like housing, education, paying off debts, you know, universal health care, and just bringing up the point that there is, that even with $300 billion removed top.
Right, which is what liberals have been talking about for years and have a lot of chatter about. But there was no flood onto the streets of this massive number of people, of which a great amount of money was spent to bring people in on planes to this meeting, to move out and, let's say, block arms going to Saudi Arabia, you know, protest here in D.C., D.C., the center of the beast, so to speak, march on the White House, nothing of that kind, no direct protests of any kind, right?
No. In fact, even like Code Pink, which attended this protest, you know, this Congress, that didn't seem to, you know, that was all happening behind the scenes as we were doing what we were doing. So, and there should be a huge protest, and it is kind of shocking that there aren't more people out on the street.
I mean, you got a bunch of people together. Admittedly, he hadn't sent out the bombers and called them back for the moment.
But
he had. There had been the bullshit about the mines and the ships being oil tankers, while the Japanese minister supposedly was actually in Tehran meeting with the boss of, you know, of Iran. So, I mean, and the sanctions are still starving the people of Iran. There seems to be no, and I'm talking about myself as well here. It's my guilt trip and mea culpa. Nobody's doing shit about this in terms of even raising the issue. It's very nice to talk about moving $300 billion from the military budget. You know, I mean, sure. But, you know, talking about it, organizing for your next meeting where you're not doing anything about putting pressure on this government to change their war policies right now is kind of too little, too late, isn't it? I mean, I don't know.
Well, I mean, this has been the, you know, for the whole 40 years I've been organizing around this, this is the first time I ever heard U.S. Congress people actively talk about, you know, food instead of bombs. So, to me, that was, you know, it's really slow. It's 40 years. And there has been, like, this, you know, the word is just legal and putting out their pie chart. And Friends, legislative committee has been talking about this. And so, but it never really made to the point where it ended up being in national media that was even a question. You know, that was usually like, oh, we don't even want to talk about that. So, you know, I think what we did was we used the politicians to, because knowing that the, you know, conversation wouldn't be national about issue of poverty and militarism unless we had people that the you know, Washington Post cared about covering. And that's why I think that rather than believing, no one was saying that these politicians would actually
do anything.
The point of them being in our at this Congress and us speaking before Congress at the Senate or Congressional Budget hearing was to attract attention that there's a movement happening surrounding poor and homeless people, and that it's obvious that we're wasting this tons of money in the military when we're allowing even our vets to live on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was made very clear that we were not endorsing candidates. We're not trying to actually get candidates to necessarily change their position. Those kinds of things, we're trying to use that as a way of getting poor people.
And yet you had whole bunches of candidates, you know, doing a showcase series of presentations and answering questions before your group, right?
Yeah, that was the purpose of that, was not so much to have anything to do with the actual politicians themselves. It was just a way that the organizers, I thought, were quite astute in that if we had all met and just talked, that would have been great. But, you know, we discussed a very concerted campaign of nonviolent direct action, blockades of roads, things like that, leading up to a national march in Washington on June 20th, 2020, but only to be manipulating the U.S. political campaign thing to get other poor people to realize that it's not their fault, that the system is completely broken, and that's why people are struggling to live.
And so the focus is, you know, while Iran gets leveled to the ground, back in the come election 2020, we'll all be able to march and activate the poor people. Is that, forgive me for putting it that way, but is
No, I don't think that's related to, I mean, I think people will I mean, it is true. It's very frustrating that there isn't a giant anti-war movement happening. But, you know.
I mean, Food Not Bombs. Well, Food Not Bombs is the name of the group you work with.
Right.
You know, and Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom is a group I work with. The most homeless people in the world are created by the wars that create all these refugees all over the world. Now, it's true that that's where most of the homeless people come from, I think, at least recently in the last couple of years. I mean,
well, I think that all people that are homeless as a direct result of a policy of spending all billions of dollars every year on preparing for war while just allowing.
I don't mean preparing for war. I'm talking about actually engaging in war. They aren't just preparing for war. They aren't just talking about a budget for 2020. All these people that you invited into your group are actively allowing this administration to continue and have enabled the Democrats in the past and are not making it a big issue in the election campaign. So I guess I'm discouraged. That's my...
Yeah, well, it is... United for Peace and Justice, which is sort of a national anti-war group and peace action... they're just setting up in Code Pink and Food Not Bombs is just struggling to, go out every week and feed people under the name Food Not Bombs and trying to get people to talk about these things. But it's true, yeah, there should be a giant blockades of highways all over the country in protest of the war and against Iran, because it would be potentially the last war.
Now,
so I totally agree.
Well, yeah, you agree, but, yet... The energies that you're engaged in, and that I'm engaged in as well, both of us are engaged in, don't point in that direction at all, really. I mean, not that our energies aren't important in what we're doing. I think, I don't know about what I'm doing. I think what you're doing is important. You're feeding people every day, you know.
I mean, there has to be a pulling together over time of some kind of a strategy. Because, for instance, right now, a lot of activists that would be in the anti-war protests are also freaking out about, Monday's roundup of immigrants, which was initially gave the impression that millions of people were going to be, interned in camps. So there's that.
Yeah, it seems to me like Trump has this deal where he can excite people and then appear to be the great conciliator by... turning back the bombers or not doing it.
Right. Yeah.
The idea of following around what Trump's latest pronouncements are is hogwash. What you really have to do is look at what his military establishment and the FBI and the NSA and the foreign bases all over the world are doing. And that has to be the focus. But none of us are focusing on that. Or if we are... There ain't too much of a direct and clear focus. And having said that, I'll, of course, move on to other things, as we usually do, which is what's coming up in the next week. Who knows? Maybe we can shift the fucking focus. I'd like to see my ass moved in that direction by something, and maybe your rhetoric and your example can do it, Keith.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, at some point, we do have to, communicate with... with people that get out on the streets against the war. And but in this town, I think it's somewhat difficult in that it's the same usual suspect.
Somewhat difficult?
Sense of lack of impact because, war is, even Mayor Watkins is war. So we could probably get her to go out to protest this. But here's another two things that I think would be good on your particular program that I've been looking into. First of all, there's a pattern of I've noticed that and done a little research on the three different recall campaigns in California, and the one that people most probably know about here is the recall of Drew and campaign for Drew Glover and Chris Krohn. And in the recall papers, one of the big problems for, what that the people doing the recall are all about is the fact that, that Chris and Drew were advocating policies, for instance, not closing Ross Camp until there was a real solutions to, a real, a transitional camp or you know, maybe...
housing for the people being displaced.
Yeah. So it turns out that the similar, that the Chico recall campaign is over the same issue. And also the L.A. recall campaign is the same exact issue. And in all three campaigns, there's also an emphasis that the homeless will, diseases will spread from the homeless community into the house community, and that we're all in danger as a result. So those are explicitly said in the Chico and in the, in all three cases. So that is one interesting thing, and so there seems to be a pattern. And
how successful are those recalls in Chico and L.A. as far as gathering signatures, do you know?
That I have no idea. I know that the L.A. one, they need, like, a lot of signatures. But the woman that's behind it is a very famous, like, right-wing TV commentator. Mm-hmm. So she might actually have some, traction there.
Today, by the way, is a special study session of the Shitty Council, for those who are interested. I don't know what it's called, a retreat or a budget analysis. So for anybody who's interested, it's going on all day. By today, of course, I mean yesterday, because people are hearing this on Sunday. And so, never mind. What's the second thing you wanted to talk about?
So the second one is people may have heard of Seattle Dying as a movie.
Yeah.
That was put out.
Anti-homeless propaganda piece, I'm aware of. I haven't seen it. Have you actually sat through that thing or not?
I couldn't watch the entire thing. I would have to skip forward a little bit. It would just be nauseating. Hmm. At some point, I should waste an hour looking at it. But I started looking into this stuff surrounding that, and I found that there was somehow it came on my radar that there was an article called An Addiction Crisis Diagnosed as a Housing Crisis. So I looked into who put that together, and it was called the Discovery Institute, which is associated with the Manhattan Institute. This idea was presented to the Manhattan Institute at one point, and it's the sort of intellectual so-called underpinning for why there's no reason to make affordable housing, and that the issue of housing is not, you know, that people are homeless because they are drug addicts, basically, and that they will never rent an apartment or anything like that. So why bother with affordable housing? What's the quote I have for them? They were, right.
Well, I think you made the point, so that's good. I know that if people want to look at Seattle is Dying, it's available online. You just go to YouTube, and it's one of the big videos I see pops up. I haven't looked at it either, except clips, you know, a few clips.
It is hard to watch, yeah.
Anything that you learned at the conference that you think we should know about here in Santa Cruz would be helpful in our organizing in the next few weeks? I mean, we were talking about doing a protest. You suggested this at the end of June when the River Street campground was supposedly ending with its funding ending. But now they're dumping funding. I guess it's the county is dumping funding into the River Street campground until next March, as well as these funds are going for the 7th Avenue and I guess maybe Laurel Street. I'm not sure. So you're getting this continued token, minor step up from token shelter, but shelter for about 150 to 200 people, if you want to look at the positive side, out of a population of 1,000 to 2,000 homeless. Admittedly, not all of them, maybe a few of them wanting the kind of shelter that these people are offering anyway. But the protest you suggested had to do with establishing alternate campgrounds or unalternate campground, particularly considering that the police seem to be stepping up their attacks on people who have no shelter but the shelter they make themselves out at the tracks and elsewhere around the town. So have you had any thoughts about that?
Well, we certainly should be organizing against that. So this is what I think is, well, one, I'm going to try to complete this flyer that I'm making that advocates a transitional camp. So I hope to get that. impact on
this. Please use a word other than transitional, since it's not transitioning into anything.
Maybe that's
survival campgrounds, maybe, or humane campground, humanitarian campground, refugee campground. I can think of a number of different words, I suppose.
Yeah, and the other thing is to try to interject, the idea of the Santa Cruz Union of the Homeless into the community and get people to start working together in that way. So, we're doing a series of things that we're working on, and one of them is to on Wednesday we're going to have like a report back and show some video and stuff about the formation of the National Union of the Homeless and what happened in D.C.
That's Wednesday night.
Yeah, Wednesday at 5 to 7 at the Resource Center for Nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
And
by the way, do we know if the Bigots United, as I like to sort of whimsically call them, or I guess it's the West Side Neighbors, that were supposed to be meeting at the police department to talk about how to get rid of them damn RV people, are they actually planning to meet again? Do we have any sense of that?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything about that.
Okay, I haven't either.
And then, of course, there's so one of the things is that, so when I talked about that recall campaign, and then there was like there seems to be some coordination between anti-homeless legislation in different cities. For instance, the Santa Cruz Together, there's also Denver Together, there's all these together things happening around the country to get rid of homeless people. So that's why it's particularly valuable to, like, get people that live on the streets to kind of feel that they are not just individual people suffering themselves, trying to survive, but that there's like a movement of uniting people to push back. And so I'm proposing that we have actual, I have not heard back from Salvation Army, but I'm trying to get a literature table in to 1220 River Street, and also a union table at the VFW and a union table at over at Laurel Street.
Have you tried calling Eric Snickars? Because you may not have his number. I can give it to you.
For some reason, he never got back to me.
Interesting.
But I think he's no longer an employee of the...
No, he's not. He is an employee, and he's continuing to work. He took a new... I don't know if he accepted a contract, because he can be fired at any time, is what he told me. I'm playing an interview with him on this same show that you're on, I hope.
Okay, well, hopefully then he'll respond to my email, so ask him about that when you interview him.
I already did have an interview, and I haven't asked him, but I could give him a call, or you could... I can give him a call.
I've been emailing him, but then I went on.
Well, email's a good idea too, because it it's the paper trail, so it's good.
Yeah, that's why I thought.
I'll send him an email too, asking about that.
Who's the new head of the Salvation Army? Who's the captain?
He doesn't. He said he didn't know at the moment, but I think Harold Lausbach is moving on. Is what you?
Yeah.
I guess you understand. Perhaps it's true. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Well, I only asked for 15 minutes, and you've given me a whole fucking half hour. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, I better go.
Is there anything you want to add about... I understand from your cook, Sea Otter, that you desperately need people who are volunteering on the Saturday when this is being recorded. It ain't possible, but possibly on the Sunday when people are listening to it, or on the next Saturday, noon, people can come volunteer at the... What is it, 418 or...?
Yeah, 418 Front Street across from the Metro. We cook at 1230, and we can use more volunteers there. There's going to be like kind of a slowdown in volunteers because people getting out of college and moving, going back home to wherever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And a transition between people getting out of college in other cities and moving to here. So always like a few weeks that are slow on the volunteer scene before.
There's also a shitty city council meeting coming up on Tuesday, which is in the evening session they have a discussion about how best to discuss or get data from our landlords, which is coming up if people are interested. Actually, that's after the oral communication session at 7. Is anything being planned by Food Not Bombs or Union of the Homeless or the fight to stop the bombing in Iraq, in Iran, anything?
No, nothing yet.
Nothing is happening.
Well, we're going to feed like 150 people today, because 150 people are...
Don't forget to put your U.S. out of Iran banner up right next to the Food Not Bombs banner.
Absolutely. Actually, that was I'd already had that idea for a while. So
good for you, man. Now, if you only had the energy and 16 versions of yourself, you'd be all set.
Right, yeah. Cool. Well, take care. You can find out more about this at foodnotbombs.net.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Keith.
Lay down your guns, I come in peace. No need to run, my friend, into the trees. We've been through this so much before, but still we calls and the juices fall like the rain from the sky. We have to understand we're the flame that feeds our desire. God knows it must survive. Lay down your guns and hold on tight.
That was, predictably enough, Lay Down Your Guns by Emerson, Lake, and Powell from the 80s. You're still tuned to the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, or one of the many, 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 many shows on the Huff website, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, under the latest and lost shows link, which gives you access to literally hundreds of old shows for all you fans of the program or historical buffs. So for those who have been patient enough to listen this far into the broadcast, you are probably aware that on June 25th, day after tomorrow, there is a City Council regular meeting. I think there was a meeting, as you will probably hear. I'm going to be playing some discussion of that, I think, although we're running out of space and time here, so to speak. There was a meeting yesterday of the city, of the council's all-day meeting, a kind of a facilitated, let's all be friends kind of meeting, which Elise Casby attended and had a kind of a brief optimistic report on, and may be able to play some of that. But tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, is a regular meeting of the city council, the last one until August, the second Tuesday in August. July is their swim and splash and vacation on the beach and that sort of thing. It's their recess. So at 10:30 a.m. in the morning on Tuesday is a closed session, which you can go to. You can actually, I may show up at that, the open interval of the closed session. It's a part of the secret process. The city council behind closed doors, which they don't let you see, which council members are forbidden to talk about and so forth. They do have, it's not really mentioned on the closed session agenda, which should mention it. It does mention a public employee performance evaluation of the city attorney and city manager, where they both should be fired and replaced, in my view, because of obstruction and imposing their own agenda and conservative interpretations that facilitate local corporate and landlord interests, not to mention anti-homeless interests. But there's also a discussion of the police department's infraction report on which ordinances are particularly impacting homeless people. Why this is not coming out in open session is kind of a mystery to me, except it was supposed to be on the open agenda. Well, it was originally slated for early May, and then City Attorney Condotti apologized and said, "I'm really sorry, we got overly busy doing all kinds of incredible work." He didn't quite put it that way, but he said he couldn't do it. So he'd have it at the next meeting in May. But to the next meeting in May, it turns out it got postponed until the first meeting in June. But at the first meeting in June, it turned out to be postponed until the second meeting in June. No, it really had to be postponed until August. The whole point of this, in my view, and the dark hand behind this is the city manager and the mayor, who essentially don't want the damning stats that show that Chief Mills is actually substituting different ordinances to criminalize homeless people in order to sort of snake his way around the Boise versus Martin decision that says no ticketing of homeless people for resting or sleeping unless you have real shelter for them, which the city is refusing to provide or allow the homeless to provide for themselves as part of their make it as difficult as possible for the homeless, you know, even if it kills them. Because after all, that in the dispersal of the Ross Camp increased the risk of rape, assault, exposure, drug overdose, and other illnesses by its dispersal. And they didn't care. In fact, they created phony excuses that they had shelter that they didn't have simply in order to do it, in order to preserve the aesthetic appearance of the city so that tourists coming in would not be shocked to see the huge amount of poverty in Santa Cruz. It's pretty sickening stuff, but unfortunately, it's pretty obvious stuff as well. So in any case, there is this thing coming up under, I'm told, this is what Drew Glover has told me, under number A, disguised under the phrase conference with legal counsel anticipated litigation, which isn't true. It isn't anticipated litigation. No one's litigating. It's just a matter of these statistics, which are public records, being exposed to the community in a public session of the City Council, as Drew Glover has been trying to do since January, when he originally proposed this, and it was deep-sixed by Mayor Martine Watkins with the collusion of, or at least the passive acceptance of, that great liberal progressive elected in concert with Drew Glover, Justin Cummings. So you can talk about that at 10:30 in the morning if you want and say, what the hell are you guys doing, for 2 minutes before she sweetly cuts you off. That's Mayor Watkins. Then if you come back at noon, there's the usual afternoon council meeting, although they shift the time around. Sometimes it's noon, sometimes it's 2:30. July is Parks and Recreation Month. You get to hear them presenting something about that. I think you should be able to respond to that. And make a, it's on the agenda after all, but they'll say, oh no, we're not taking any action. Actually, they are. They're engaging in PR action to essentially pretty up what is now actually an anti-homeless enforcement squad, instead of being an educational park beautification group, which I think was what Parks and Rec sounds like it's supposed to be, and what it perhaps originally was. They're going to welcome a student delegation from Italy who should be told about the abuses against homeless people, against renters, against citizens generally trying to hold the police department accountable and get real stats on what's going on there, or even get action from the city council on long-stalled measures. The consent agenda, before we get to the consent agenda, here's a point. The council meeting calendar is item 5 on the agenda, and that is something that has been moved from its traditional position at the end of the city council agenda to the beginning. You might say, well, that's nice because, I mean, you don't have to wait up late in the evening or late in the afternoon to hear this if you, for some reason you want to. But in fact, there are some of us who think there's a darker motive involved, though we don't have the paper trail to prove it. And that is that at the last, and at several of these council meeting calendars, because it has not been possible to get items on the agenda by civilly presenting to the mayor your staff reports, this is what council members have done, Glover, Brown, and Crone, and saying, we want this item on the agenda, three of us want it on, we probably have a fourth vote, let's put it on so we can put it forward. She has been deep-sixing these items and delaying them and not putting them on the agenda at all. And finally cramming them onto agenda where then she says, oh, we have no time, we have to rush through this, which is what happened to Glover's many items that got shoved onto the onto one agenda. But this whole process can be confronted and has been confronted on occasion, but not frequently enough, by a council majority voting at a council to say, sorry, Mayor Watkins, you can't secretly keep items off the agenda. We are going to have this on the next agenda, and it gets put on the agenda by the vote of 4-3, or whatever the vote is if it's a majority at the city council. This happened in the at the last meeting on the resolution of Justin Cummings, who apparently defected from the reactionary majority that he has been all too frequently voting with, and in order to get some stats on renters and landlords. And this, of course, upset the landlord lobby, which is Matthews, Myers, and Watkins, not to mention Martine Bernal, because they don't want the stats revealing the true situation of the real profits of landlords in Santa Cruz, the real costs that they supposedly are just groaning under. They have to raise rents the way they do. This is my prejudice, bias, suspicion. But I'd like to see some hard data. And apparently so would Justin Cummings, who disappointed severely and I think betrayed his constituency in January by first voting for rent control and just eviction protection and then voting against it and killing it and deep-sixing it for the year under the threat of recall. So he apparently has survived a recall, but his friends, his colleagues, his political allies are under assault. That's Glover and Crone. But here, apparently, he was wanting to, you know, back up a bit and say, well, here, let's find out what's going on with the renters and landlords. So he didn't require the staff to do what they should have done at the very beginning, which is to gather data on landlords and tenants, or, you know, how much of rent's been raised, what kind of expenses landlords have, how many people have been evicted. The various suggestions made by tenant advocate Cynthia Berger have been presented, and apparently Justin Cummings was listening. And so he introduced at the last meeting, realizing apparently that he finally that the mayor is not going to respond to the nice guy approach, even though he may be accused of being rude, abusive, and sexist, which seems to be her strategy when she's confronted with a majority vote she doesn't like. He, at the council meeting calendar section of the agenda last time, at the end of the meeting, moved that this item about the at least setting up a procedure by which landlords and renters and so forth would be, well, the stats would be gathered. I'm not sure if any stats actually have been gathered. I got to examine that one a little more closely. So what was requested was the feasibility of a review of the feasibility assessment of a rental housing task force. That was a report was issued where the guy who was the consultant said, you can't do it. There's too much opposition. You're not going to get a good rental housing task force. People just disagree. The council directed staff to return on the next agenda. This was due to Justin Cummings' forced vote on this to make sure that Watkins did this, put it on the agenda instead of sending it off to the winter somewhere. To directed staff to return on the next agenda with a report on the resources needed to begin collecting rental housing data, including rental leases, rental rate increases, notices to quit, and evictions in the city of Santa Cruz. The staff has provided the following report to provide a frame of reference. I'm looking at the staff report. I'm reading to you from it. Some preliminary background in support of the city council's conversation on this topic. So again, it's endless conversation. I mean, instead of saying, you know, bring us the data or bring us a specific proposal for actually getting the data. I mean, maybe that's really what they're asking for, but it seems awfully roundabout. They're giving you how the city of San Jose does it, Mountain View, Alameda, Berkeley, and Los Angeles. Questions for consideration about data. What's the goal? How will it be used? What information is most important to collect? But, you know, this it was a specific request for particular information, i.e. evictions, rental rate increases, rental leases, notices to quit. I think it should also look into landlord rent raises. I guess that is rental rate increases. But also, I would say, to be fair to landlords, mortgage property rate increases, because that's one of the expenses that a landlord has. But I'd say just generally landlord expenses should be added to this. But they're specific about it. The resolution is specific. So why do you have to discuss further what the goal of the data production is? How will it be used? By whom? And how frequently? In other words, suddenly throwing 100 questions up rather than getting to the issue is the standard strategy that's being used to avoid really addressing housing issues for the last 3 years. You talk it to death. You exhaust people. And then when people object that you're not dealing with it, you say, hey, we've spent hundreds of hours talking about it. It's quite a familiar strategy at the Santa Cruz City Council. So in any case, my point here is not that nothing is happening on this item, even though that's kind of what's going on, although at least there is a certain... Cummings is attempting to focus on the item, and of course, the city staff is doing everything it can to disperse any energy around the issue, because who is the one who approves it? Martin Bernal, city manager, the guy who's actually coming up for review at the closed session on this same session. You want Bernal out? Show up at 10:30 and say so. Although, of course, they won't be listening to you, but it is televised. And it's very nice to have the community know, because they're probably out there are people who agree with you that they are not alone and you are not alone in saying the obvious, that someone is sabotaging the situation and sending money into the coffers of developers and large builders and the seaside company and the police department, and not where it needs to go, into the needs of people who are in trouble in Santa Cruz and who are really, in a way, if not the bedrock of Santa Cruz, the heart and the core of Santa Cruz and the responsibility of Santa Cruz.